This is Oral Fixation on the Stories I Wish You Heard. The violent explosion which made Mrs. Dalloway jump and Miss Pym go to the window and apologize came from a motor car which had drawn to the side of the pavement precisely opposite Mulberry's shop window. Passers-by, who of course stopped and stared, had just time to see a face of the very greatest importance against the dove-gray upholstery, before a male hand drew the blind, and there was nothing to be seen except a square of dove-gray. Yet rumors were at once in circulation, from the middle of Bond Street to Oxford Street on one side, to Atkinson's scent shop on the other, passing invisibly, inaudibly, like a cloud, swift, veil-like upon hills, falling indeed with something of a cloud's sudden sobriety and stillness upon faces which a second before had been utterly disorderly. But now, mystery had brushed them with her wing. They had heard the voice of authority. The spirit of religion was abroad with her eyes bandaged tight and her lips gaping wide. But nobody knew whose face had been seen. Was it the Prince of Wales's? The Queen's? The Prime Minister's? Whose face was it? Nobody knew. Edgar J. Watkiss, with his roll of lead piping round his arm, said audibly, humorously of course, "The Prime Minister's car." Septimus Warren Smith, who found himself unable to pass, heard him. Septimus Warren Smith, aged about 30, pale-faced, beak-nosed, wearing brown shoes and a shabby overcoat, with hazel eyes which had that look of apprehension in them, which makes complete strangers apprehensive too. The world has raised its whip. Where will it descend? Everything had come to a standstill. The throb of the motor engines sounded like a pulse irregularly drumming through an entire body. The sun became extraordinarily hot because the motor car had stopped outside Mulberry's shop window. Old ladies on the tops of omnibuses spread their black parasols, here a green, here a red parasol opened with a little pop. Mrs. Dalloway, coming to the window with her arms full of sweet peas, looked out with her little pink face pursed in inquiry. Everyone looked at the motor car. Septimus looked, boys on bicycles sprang off, traffic accumulated, and there the motor car stood, with drawn blinds, and upon them a curious pattern like a tree. Septimus thought, and this gradual drawing together of everything to one center before his eyes, as if some horror had come almost to the surface and was about to burst into flames, terrified him. The world wavered and quivered and threatened to burst into flames. "It is I who am blocking the way," he thought. Was he not being looked at and pointed at? Was he not weighed there, rooted to the pavement for a purpose? But for what purpose? "Let us go on, Septimus," said his wife, a little woman with large eyes and a sallow pointed face, an Italian girl. But Lucretia herself could not help looking at the motor car and the tree pattern on the blinds. Was it the Queen in there? The Queen going shopping? The chauffeur, who had been opening something, turning something, shutting something, got onto the box. "Come on," said Lucretia. But her husband, for they had been married 4-5 years now, jumped, started, and said, "All right," angrily, as if she had interrupted him. People must notice. People must see. People, she thought, looking at the crowd staring at the motor car. The English people, with their children and their horses and their clothes, which she admired in a way. But they were people now, because Septimus had said, "I will kill myself." An awful thing to say. Suppose they had heard him. She looked at the crowd. "Help. Help, she wanted to cry out to the butchers, boys, and women. Help. Only last autumn, she and Septimus had stood on the embankment, wrapped in the same cloak, and Septimus, reading a paper, instead of talking, she had snatched it from him and laughed in the old man's face who saw them. But failure one conceals. She mistake him away into some park. Now we will cross, she said. She had a right to his arm, though it was without feeling. He would give her, who was so simple, so impulsive, only 24, without friends in England, who had left Italy for his sake, a piece of bone. The motor car, with its blinds drawn and an air of inscrutable reserve, proceeded towards Piccadilly, still gazed at, still ruffling the faces on both sides of the street with the same dark breath of veneration, whether for queen, prince, or prime minister, nobody knew. The face itself had been seen only once by three people for a few seconds. Even the sex was now in dispute, but there could be no doubt that greatness was seated within. Greatness was passing, hidden, down Bond Street, removed only by a hand's breadth from ordinary people who might now, for the first and last time, be within speaking distance of the majesty of England, of the enduring symbol of the state which will be known to curious antiquaries, sifting the ruins of time when London is a grass-grown path, and all those hurrying along the pavement this Wednesday morning are but bones with a few wedding rings mixed up in their dust and the gold stoppings of innumerable decayed teeth. The face in the motor car will then be known. It is probably the Queen, thought Mrs. Dalloway, coming out of Mulberry's with her flowers. The Queen. And for a second, she wore a look of extreme dignity, standing by the flower shop in the sunlight while the car passed at a foot's pace, with its blinds drawn. The Queen, going to some hospital, the Queen opening some bazaar, thought Clarissa. The crush was terrific for the time of day. Lords, Ascot, Hurlingham, what was it? She wondered, for the street was blocked. The British middle classes sitting sideways on the tops of omnibuses with parcels and umbrellas, yes, even furs on a day like this were, she thought, more ridiculous, more unlike anything there has ever been that one could conceive, and the Queen herself held up, the Queen herself unable to pass. Clarissa was suspended on one side of Brook Street, Sir John Buckhurst, the old judge on the other, with a car between them. Sir John had laid down the law for years and liked a well-dressed woman. When the chauffeur, leaning ever so slightly, said or showed something to the policeman, who saluted and raised his arm and jerked his hand and moved the omnibus to the side, and the car passed through. Slowly and very silently, it took its way. Clarissa guessed. Clarissa knew, of course. She had seen something white, magical, circular in the footman's hand. A disc inscribed with a name. The Queen's, the Prince of Wales's, the Prime Minister's, which, by force of its own luster, burnt its way through. Clarissa saw the car diminishing, disappearing, to blaze among candelabras, glittering stars, breasts stiff with oak leaves. Hugh Whitbread and all his colleagues, the gentlemen of England, that night in Buckingham Palace, and Clarissa, too, gave a party. She stiffened a little, so she would stand at the top of her stairs. The car had gone, but it had left a slight ripple which flowed through glove shops and hat shops and tailor shops on both sides of Bond Street. For 30 seconds, all heads were inclined the same way, to the window, choosing a pair of gloves, should they be to the elbow or above it, lemon or pale gray. Ladies stopped. When the sentence was finished, something had happened. Something so trifling in single instances that no mathematical instrument, though capable of transmitting shocks in China, could register the vibration. Yet, in its fullness rather formidable, and in its common appeal emotional. For in all the hat shops and tailor shops, strangers looked at each other and thought of the dead, of the flag, of empire. In a public house in a back street, a colonial insulted the House of Windsor, which led to words, broken beer glasses, and a general shindy, which echoed strangely across the way in the ears of girls buying white under linen, threaded with pure white ribbon for their weddings. for the surface agitation of the passing car as it sunk grazed something very profound. Gliding across Piccadilly, the car turned down St. James's Street. Tall men, men of robust physique, well-dressed men with their tailcoats and their white slips and their hair raked back who, for reasons difficult to discriminate, were standing in the bow window of Brooks with their hands behind the tails of their coats, looking out, perceived instinctively that greatness was passing, and the pale light of the immortal presence fell upon them as it had fallen upon Clarissa Dalloway. At once they stood even straighter and removed their hands and seemed ready to attend their sovereign, if need be, to the cannon's mouth, as their ancestors had done before them. The white busts and the little tables in the background, covered with copies of the Tatler and siphons of soda water, seemed to approve, seemed to indicate the flowing corn in the manor houses of England, and to return the frail hum of the motor wheels, as the wall of a whispering gallery returned a single voice, expanded and made sonorous by the might of a whole cathedral. Shawled Moll Pratt, with her flowers on the pavement, wished the dear boy well. It was the Prince of Wales for certain, and would have tossed the price of a pot of beer, a bunch of roses, into St. James Street, out of sheer lightheartedness and contempt of poverty, had she not seen the constable's eye upon her, discouraging an old Irishwoman's loyalty. The sentries at St. James saluted. Queen Alexandra's policemen approved. A small crowd, meanwhile, had gathered at the gates of Buckingham Palace, listlessly yet confidently. Poor people, all of them, they waited. Looked at the palace itself with the flag flying, at Victoria billowing on her mound, admired her shelves of running water, her geraniums, singled out from the motor cars in the mall, first this one, then that, bestowed emotion vainly upon commoners out for a drive, recalled their tribute to keep it unspent while this car passed, and that, and all the time let rumor accumulating in their veins, and thrill the nerves in their thighs at the thought of royalty looking at them, the queen bowing, the prince saluting, and the thought of the heavenly life divinely bestowed upon kings, of the equerries and deep curtsies, of the queen's old dollhouse, of Princess Mary married to an Englishman, and the prince, ah, the prince, who took wonderfully, they said, after old King Edward, but he was ever so much slimmer. The prince lived at St. James's, but he might come along in the morning to visit his mother. So Sarah Bletchley said with her baby in her arms, tipping her foot up and down as though she were by her own fender in Pimlico, but keeping her eyes on the mall, while Emily Coates ranged over the palace windows and thought of the housemaids, the innumerable housemaids, the bedrooms, the innumerable bedrooms, joined by an elderly gentleman with an Aberdeen terrier, by men without occupation, the crowd increased. Little Mr. Bowley, who had rooms in the Albany, and was sealed with wax over the deeper sources of life, but could be unsealed suddenly, inappropriately, sentimentally, by this sort of thing, poor women waiting to see the Queen go past. Poor women, nice little children, orphans, widows, the war tut-tut actually had tears in his eyes, a breeze flaunting ever so warmly down the mall through the thin trees, past the bronze heroes, lifted some flag flying in the British breast of Mr. Bowley, and he raised his hat as the car turned into the mall and held it in high as the car approached, and let the poor mothers of Pimlico press close to him and stood very upright. The car came on. Suddenly Mrs. Coates looked up into the sky. The sound of an airplane bored ominously into the ears of the crowd. There it was, coming over the trees, letting out white smoke from behind, which curled and twisted, actually writing something, making letters in the sky. Everyone looked up. Dropping dead down the airplane, soared straight up, curved in a loop, raised, sank, rose, and whatever it did, wherever it went, out fluttered behind it a thick ruffled bar of white smoke which curled and wreathed upon the sky in letters. But what letters? A, C, was it? An E? And then an L? Only for a moment did they lie still. Then they moved and melted and were rubbed out up in the sky. and the airplane shot further away and again, in a fresh space of sky, began writing a K, an E, a Y perhaps. "Glaxo," said Mrs. Coates in a strained, awe-stricken voice, gazing straight up, and her baby, lying stiff and white in her arms, gazed straight up. "Cremo," murmured Mrs. Bletchley, like a sleepwalker. With his hat held out perfectly still in his hand, Mr. Bowley gazed straight up. All down, the mall people were standing and looking up into the sky. As they looked, the whole world became perfectly still, and a flight of gulls crossed the sky, first one gull leading, then another, and in this extraordinary silence and peace, in this pallor and this purity, bells struck 11 times, the sound fading up there among the gulls. The airplane turned and raced and swooped exactly where it liked, swiftly, freely, like a skater. "That's an E," said Mrs. Bletchley, "or a dancer." "It's toffee," murmured Mr. Bowley, and the car went in at the gates and nobody looked at it, and shutting off the smoke, away and away it rushed, and the smoke faded and assembled itself round the broad white shapes of the clouds. It had gone. It was behind the clouds. There was no sound. The clouds to which the letters E, G, or L had attached themselves moved freely, as if destined to cross from west to east on a mission of the greatest importance, which would never be revealed, and yet certainly, so it was, a mission of the greatest importance. Then suddenly, as a train comes out of a tunnel, the airplane rushed out of the clouds again, the sound boring into the ears of all people in the mall, in the Green Park, in Piccadilly, in Regent Street, in Regent's Park. And the bar of smoke curved behind it, and it dropped down, and it soared up, and wrote one letter after another. But what word was it writing? Lucretia Warren Smith, sitting by her husband's side on a seat in Regent's Park in the Broadwalk, looked up. "Look, look, Septimus," she cried. For Dr. Holmes had told her to make her husband, who had nothing whatsoever seriously the matter with him, but was a little out of sorts, take an interest in things outside himself. "So," thought Septimus, looking up, "they are signaling to me." Not indeed in actual words, that is. He could not read the language yet. But it was plain enough, this beauty, this exquisite beauty, and tears filled his eyes as he looked at the smoke words, languishing and melting in the sky, and bestowing upon him in their inexhaustible charity and laughing goodness, one shape after another of imaginable beauty, and signaling their intention to provide him for nothing, forever, for looking merely with beauty, more beauty. Tears ran down his cheeks. It was toffee. They were advertising toffee, a nursemaid told Risha. Together they began to spell T-O-F-K-R, said the nursemaid, and Septimus heard her say K-R close to his ear, deeply, softly, like a mellow organ, but with a roughness in her voice like a grasshopper's, which rasped his spine deliciously and sent running up into his brain waves of sound which, concussing, broke. A marvelous discovery indeed that the human voice, in certain atmospheric conditions, for one must be scientific, above all scientific, can quicken trees into life. Happily, Risha put her hand with a tremendous weight on his knee so that he was weighted down, transfixed, or the excitement of the elm trees rising and falling with all their leaves alight and the color thinning and thickening from blue to the green of a hollow wave, like plumes on horses' heads, feathers on ladies, so proudly they rose and fell, so superbly would have sent him mad, but he would not go mad. He would shut his eyes. He would see no more. But they beckoned. Leaves were alive. Trees were alive. And the leaves being connected by millions of fibers with his own body, there on the street, fanned it up and down. When the branch stretched, he too made that statement. The sparrows fluttering, rising and falling, in jagged fountains were part of the pattern. The white and blue, barred with black branches, sounds made harmonies with premeditation. The spaces between them were as significant as the sounds. A child cried. Rightly far away, a horn sounded. All taken together meant the birth of a new religion. Septimus, said Risha. He started violently. People must notice. I am going to walk to the fountain and back, she said. For she could stand it no longer. Dr. Holmes might say there was nothing the matter. Far rather would she that he were dead. She could not sit beside him when he stared so, and did not see her, and made everything terrible. Sky and tree, children playing, dragging carts, blowing whistles, falling down, all were terrible. And he would not kill himself, and she could tell no one. Septimus has been working too hard. That was all she could say to her own mother. To love makes one solitary, she thought. She could tell nobody, not even Septimus now. And looking back, she saw him sitting in his shabby overcoat alone, on the seat, hunched up staring. And it was cowardly for a man to say he would kill himself, but Septimus had fought. He was brave. He was not Septimus now. She put on her lace collar. She put on her new hat and he never noticed, and he was happy without her. Nothing could make her happy without him. Nothing. He was selfish, so men are, for he was not ill. Dr. Holmes said there was nothing the matter with him. She spread her hand before her. Look, her wedding ring slipped. She had grown so thin. It was she who suffered, but she had nobody to tell. Far was Italy, and the white houses, in the room where her sisters sat making hats, in the streets crowded every evening with people walking, laughing out loud, not half alive like people here, huddled up in bath chairs, looking at a few ugly flowers stuck in pots. For you should see the Milan gardens, she said out loud. But to whom? There was nobody. Her words faded, so a rocket fades. Its sparks, having grazed their way into the night, surrender to it. Dark descends, pours over the outlines of houses and towers. Bleak hillsides soften and fall in, but they thought they are gone. The night is full of them, robbed of color, blank of windows. They exist more ponderously, give out what the frank daylight fails to transmit. The trouble and suspense of things conglomerated there in the darkness, huddled together in the darkness. Reft of the relief which dawn brings, washing the walls white and gray, spotting each window pane, lifting the mist from the fields, showing the red-brown cows peacefully grazing, all is once more decked out to the eye. Exists again. I am alone. I am alone, she cried, by the fountain in Regent's Park, staring at the Indian and his cross. As perhaps at midnight, when all boundaries are lost, the country reverts to its ancient shape as the Romans saw it, lying cloudy when they landed, and the hills had no names, and rivers wound they knew not where. Such was her darkness. When suddenly, as if a shelf were shot forth and she stood on it, she said how she was his wife, married years ago in Milan, his wife, and would never, never tell that he was mad. Turning, the shelf fell, down, down she dropped, for he was gone, she thought. Gone, as he threatened to kill himself, to throw himself under a cart. But no, there he was, still sitting alone on the seat, in a shabby overcoat, his legs crossed, staring, talking aloud. Men must not cut down trees. There is a God. He noted such revelations on the backs of envelopes. Change the world. No one kills from hatred. Make it known. He wrote it down. He waited. He listened. A sparrow perched on the railing opposite chirped Septimus, Septimus, 4 or 5 times over, and went on, drawing its notes out, to sing freshly and piercingly. In Greek words, how there is no crime. And joined by another sparrow, they sang in voices prolonged and piercing in Greek words, from trees in the meadow of life, beyond the river where the dead walk, how there is no death. There was his hand, there the dead. White things were assembling behind the railings opposite, but he dared not look. Evans was behind the railings. "What are you saying?" said Risha suddenly, sitting down by him. Interrupted again. She was always interrupting. "Away from people. We must get away from people," he said, jumping up right away over there, where there were chairs beneath the tree, and the long slope of the park dipped like a length of green stuff, with a ceiling cloth of blue and pink smoke high above, and there was a rampart of far irregular houses, haste and smoke. The traffic hummed in a circle, and on the right, dun-colored animals stretched long necks over the zoo palings, barking, howling. There they sat down under a tree. "Look," she implored him, pointing at a little troop of boys carrying cricket stumps. And one shuffled, spun around on his heel and shuffled, as if he were acting a clown at the music hall. "Look," she implored him, for Dr. Holmes had told her to make him notice real things. Go to a music hall, play cricket. That was the very game, Dr. Holmes said, a nice out-of-door game, the very game for her husband. "Look," she repeated. "Look," the unseen bade him, the voice which now communicated with him, who was the greatest of mankind. Septimus, lady taken from life to death, the Lord who had come to renew society, who lay like a coverlid, a snow blanket smitten only by the sun, forever wasted, suffering forever, the scapegoat, the eternal sufferer. But he did not want it, he moaned, putting from him with a wave of his hand that eternal suffering, that eternal loneliness. "Look," she repeated, for he must not talk aloud to himself out of doors. "Oh, look," she implored him. But what was there to look at? A few sheep, that was all. The way to Regent's Park Tube Station. Could they tell her the way to Regent's Park Tube Station? Maisie Johnson wanted to know. She was only up from Edinburgh 2 days ago. "Not this way. Over there," Risha exclaimed, waving her aside, lest she should see Septimus. Both seemed queer, Maisie Johnson thought. Everything seemed very queer. In London, for the first time, came to take up a post at her uncle's in Leadenhall Street, and now walking through Regent's Park in the morning, this couple on the chairs gave her quite a turn. The young woman seeming foreign, the man looking queer, so that should she be very old, she would still remember, and make it jangle again among her memories, how she had walked through Regent's Park on a fine summer's morning 50 years ago. For she was only 19, and had got her way, at least, to come to London. And now, how queer it was, this couple she had asked the way of, and the girl started and jerked her hand, and the man, he seemed awfully odd, quarreling perhaps, parting forever. Perhaps something was up, she knew, and now all these people, for she returned to the broad walk, the stone basins, the prim flowers, the old men and women, invalids most of them in bath chairs, all seemed, after Edinburgh, so queer. And Maisie Johnson, as she joined that gently trudging, vaguely gazing, breeze-kissed company squirrels perching and preening, sparrow fountains fluttering for crumbs, dogs busy with the railings, busy with each other, while the soft warm air washed over them and lent to the fixed unsurprised gaze with which they received life, something whimsical and mollified, Maisie Johnson positively felt she must cry. Oh, for that young man on the seat had given her quite a turn. Something was up, she knew. Horror, horror, she wanted to cry. She had left her people. They had warned her what would happen. Why hadn't she stayed at home? She cried, twisting the knob of the iron railing. That girl, thought Mrs. Dempster, who saved crusts for the squirrels and often ate her lunch in Regent's Park, don't know a thing yet. And really it seemed to her better to be a little stout, a little slack, a little moderate in one's expectations. Percy drank. Well, better to have a son, thought Mrs. Dempster. She had had a hard time of it, and couldn't help smiling at a girl like that. You'll get married, for you're pretty enough, thought Mrs. Dempster. Get married, she thought, and then you'll know. Oh, the cooks, and so on. Every man has his ways. But whether I'd have chosen quite like that, if I could have known, thought Mrs. Dempster, and could not help wishing to whisper a word to Maisie Johnson, to feel on the creased pouch of her worn old face the kiss of pity. For it's been a hard life, thought Mrs. Dempster. What hadn't she given to it? Roses, figure, her feet too. She drew the knobbed lumps beneath her skirt. Roses, she thought sardonically. All trash, my dear. For really, what with eating, drinking, and mating, the bad days and good, life had been no more matter of roses. And what was more, let me tell you, Carrie Dempster had no wish to change her lot with any woman's in Kentish Town. But, she implored, pity. Pity for the loss of roses. Pity, she asked of Maisie Johnson, standing by the hyacinth beds. Ah, but that airplane. Hadn't Mrs. Dempster always longed to see foreign parts? She had a nephew, a missionary. It was sword and shot. She always went on the sea at Margate. Not out of sight of land, but she had no patience with women who were afraid of water. It swept and fell. Her stomach was in her mouth. Up again, there's a fine young feller aboard of it. Mrs. Dempster wagered, and away it went, fast and fading. Away and away, the airplane shot, soaring over Greenwich and all the masts, over the little island of grey churches, St. Paul's and the rest still, on either side of London. Fields spread out in dark brown woods where adventurous thrushes, hopping boldly, glancing quickly, snatched the snail and tapped him on a stone. Once, twice, thrice. Away and away the airplane shot, till it was nothing but a bright spark. An aspiration, a concentration, a symbol, so it seemed to Mr. Bentley, vigorously rolling his strip of turf at Greenwich, of man's soul. Of his determination, thought Mr. Bentley, sweeping around the cedar tree to get outside his body, beyond his house, by means of thought. Einstein, speculation, mathematics, the Mendelian theory, away the airplane shot. Then, while a seedy-looking, nondescript man carrying a leather bag stood on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral and hesitated, for within what was bomb, how great a welcome. How many tombs with banners waving over them, tokens of victories, not over armies, but over, he thought, that plaguey spirit of truth-seeking which leaves me at present, without a situation. And more than that, the cathedral offers company, he thought, invites you to membership of a society. Great men belong to it. Martyrs have died for it. Why not enter in, he thought, put this leather bag stuffed with pamphlets before an altar, a cross, the symbol of something which has soared beyond seeking and questing and knocking of words together, and has become all spirit, disembodied, ghostly. Why not enter in, he thought, and while he hesitated, out flew the airplane over Ludgate Circus. It was strange. It was still. Not a sound was to be heard above the traffic. Unguided, it seemed, sped of its own free will. And now, curving up and up and straight up, like something mounting in ecstasy, in pure delight, out from behind poured white smoke looping, writing a T, an O, an F.